Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. Matthew J. O'Brien is in the house, virtually at least. He is the director of research at a very important organization in Washington, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. I have the privilege of being with FAIR, as it's called, at their recent Hold Their Feet to the Fire radio row program, and we broadcast from there last week. I did not come across Matt, I'm sorry to say, but I'm very pleased to have him with us now by phone. Matt has served for some 20 years in a variety of capacities, including in government, notably in the Customs and Immigration Service, where he was the chief of the National Security Division within its Fraud Detection and National Security Directorate. Matt, it is very good to have you with us. Thank you very much for taking your time.
Thank you very much.
You have been writing on a variety of topics that I think it's important for our audience to hear from someone, particularly with your experience in this immigration law portfolio as a practitioner, as well as an observer and commentator. I'd like to start, though, with this attack on the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Organization. It has most recently been buffeted by another federal judge telling ICE, as it's called, that it can't arrest people, illegal immigrants in Massachusetts. What is going on here with the assault on ICE in general, and what are the implications in particular if this judge's ruling is upheld?
Well, what's going on is that a lot of people who simply don't believe that there should be any immigration laws at all and don't like any kind of immigration enforcement are trying to convince the public that somehow enforcing immigration laws using the federal law enforcement agency ICE that was intended to do this is inhumane. And what they're claiming is that there are violations of human rights and so on and so forth, which is completely ridiculous. What happened in Massachusetts is that Citizenship and Immigration Services, the organization that I worked for as the chief of the National Security Division, is responsible for adjudicating immigration applications submitted by people who are seeking immigration benefits. And it's a common practice when those people are either unlawfully present in the United States, have an outstanding deportation order, have a criminal warrant, for CIS to coordinate with ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and I spent many years working as assistant chief counsel with them, in order to arrest these folks and either put them under an order of supervision so ICE knows where they are, or if they present a danger to the public, to detain them. And a federal court in Massachusetts, based on a lawsuit filed by the ACLU, has bought the ACLU's argument that some very suspect regulations that were put in place by the Obama administration to support the DACA program prohibits ICE now from arresting these people. And it's just a foolish argument. Mm.
And yet, evidently, it has been upheld by, an Obama-appointed judge, perhaps, but at the very least by a federal judge. Do you expect, Matt O'Brien, that this will be appealed? And if so, that the appellate court will uphold this evidently foolish ruling?
I think it will most likely be appealed. One of the things that the Trump administration has done that has been fantastic is it actually reacts to these, where in past years, all of the immigration agencies would simply roll over and take whatever decision was issued by the courts. So hopefully this will be directly appealed. The First Circuit, unfortunately, is trending very similarly to the Ninth Circuit, taking a lot of very radical positions. Massachusetts is not noted for being conservative, and I think that's starting to be reflected in the federal bench there. So I think that the appellate court most likely will uphold this. The question is whether regulations passed by USCIS to deal with applications being filed by people with certain types of immigration issues can be binding on ICE to influence its arrest authority, and it will really depend upon how the court approaches the issue.
Mm-hmm. And is it the case in this instance that the judge ruled narrowly on the matter within the jurisdiction of his court, as opposed to putting down some sort of nationwide fiat that would interfere with ICE's arrest authority elsewhere as well?
He didn't rule narrowly in a geographical sense, in that he addressed the practices in Massachusetts. Now, the federal agencies that deal with immigration have had a tendency to treat every district court and circuit court opinion as if it's binding in the whole United States. I think that will probably not be the case under the Trump administration. I think what's complicated in this particular case is you may have other federal courts try and use this, despite the fact that it's a district court case, as precedent and react accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to a related topic, if I may, Matt. The right, or what is sometimes called the right, has increasingly, it appears, been riven by some who really favor the more or less open borders line of the left. I'm thinking particularly of an argument made in The Federalist that the Molly Tibbetts murder was an argument for actually loosening the immigration laws. And at the Cato Institute, a fellow there by the name of Alex Naraste, who seems to be all in on the open borders line, is holding forth that similarly we ought to be relaxing our immigration laws, not trying to enforce them. What are these people up to? Where are they coming from? And how would you respond to their recommendations?
Well, the article in The Federalist, which I wrote a blog in response to, just didn't make any sense to me. I'm not sure where the author was coming from. He seemed to say that, you know, we're driving people into the shadows, and that's what creates all of the debate about immigrants and crime. But it didn't seem to be a very strong argument. It just struck me as this kind of utopian fantasist nonsense.
So a lot of that going on at the moment, I'm afraid.
Unfortunately, it's infecting far too many things in the United States, and it's probably most dangerous with regard to immigration, because borders are what preserve our sovereignty, allow us to draw a line around the United States and say, this is the zone in which you will live according to our laws and constitution. Mr. Naraste has got a slightly different take. He is a what I would classify as a libertarian and anarcho-capitalist, and those are folks who believe that the market should regulate everything. So his fundamental notion is that if you have a free market, you shouldn't have borders, because the borders will be self-set as people come to a given place looking for jobs, and that you'll only be able to take in as many people as can work. Of course, that's foolish, because we all know that a free market is dependent upon two things. One, a government that maintains enough order so that you can trade. And number two, property rights that can be enforced in courts. And if you sort of ignore the legal aspects of immigration and the sovereignty and border aspects, you're ignoring those fundamental preconditions for the market.
Yeah, we look forward to talking with you further about this, Matt. In the meantime, thank you for your past service in government and that you're rendering to the country at FAIR. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Yoram Hazony joins us from Israel next, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a delight to say we are joined for the first time, I believe, on this radio program by a man that I've known for some time and have admired greatly, almost from afar, for the most part. His name is Yoram Hazony. He is these days the president of the Herzl Institute in Jerusalem. He's also the director of the John Templeton Foundation's project in Jewish philosophical theology. A man of many parts with impressive credentials in academia and in the world of the essayist, the author of numerous books, the most recent of which is just out. It is entitled The Virtue of Nationalism. I hope to have Yoram on for a long conversation about this, because we won't be able to do justice to it in the shortness of this segment, but I'm so pleased to have him back. Welcome, Yoram Hazony.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you for having me.
Well, the pleasure is mine, especially because I have been very interested to talk with someone about this new law that has precipitated considerable controversy, mostly outside of Israel, I guess, the law of the nation state of the Jewish people. And I know this is very much imbued with some of your thinking about nationalism. And just walk us through kind of the argument for that law and the larger case for nationalism as you see it.
Well, I think that the part that's the aspects of the law that have been mostly missed in the overseas discussion about it is that the nation state law doesn't really contain anything or virtually anything that is new. It's basically an articulation of the Israeli constitutional tradition going back to the founding of the state and before that. So what you find in the law is a declaration that Israel is the national state of the Jewish people, and it enshrines in law Jewish holidays and the Jewish Sabbath, which were always part of Israeli law. It makes recognizes Hebrew as the national language, which has always been the case. And it describes the aim of ingathering the Jewish exiles, and so forth. All of these things, the idea of Jewish settlement on the land, all of these things are to be found in Israel's Declaration of Independence. So, and then codified in various pieces of legislation over the years and upheld by Israeli courts, all the way up until the 1990s. So it's a description of Israeli constitutional tradition, except that beginning in the 1990s, the Israeli Supreme Court — this should sound somewhat familiar to American listeners — the Israeli Supreme Court took a radical turn in the direction of political activism. In 1992, declared a constant what the head of the Supreme Court then, Aaron Barak, later called the Constitutional Revolution. And the idea of the Constitutional Revolution, if I could simplify it, was that the Israeli Supreme Court could adapt general universal liberal principles as it understands them and use them in order to overturn any Jewish traditional aspect of the country. And this is something that has been furiously debated for many years. I myself have written about it quite a bit over the years, calling for what's in effect a constitutional amendment, which resets the Israeli legal tradition back prior to 1992 to preserve its character as the state of the Jewish people.
Basically getting back to founding principles. And Yoram Hazony, this has been received as some horrifically racist document in some quarters that has horrifically prejudicial implications for the Palestinians or other Arabs in Israel. And I just, again, would ask you to walk us through the importance of the Jewish people having a nation state and the argument that this law is not only consistent with that character from its founding, but also required, really, to assure the survival of that state.
It's important, I think, for your listeners to know, because not all of them are aware, I suspect, that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Every minority, whether they're Arab or belong to other minorities, has the right to vote in Israel. We have in Israel Arab and minority members of parliament. We have Arab Supreme Court justices. We have a Druze minister. And so it's kind of portrayed in, you know, in outside of Israel as though Israel has somehow become, as you say, some kind of Jewish tyranny.
Apartheid state and all of that.
Right. I think that this is actually the one place that if an Arab man or woman wanted to experience freedom in the way that Western countries grant it, they would have to move to Israel, because that doesn't exist in our neighborhood except here. But on the other hand, it's true that Israel is not founded to be a state devoted to all peoples. It is a state devoted to the aspirations and the hopes and dreams of the Jewish people. That's not just something in Israel's Declaration of Independence. The United Nations recognized Israel as the state of the Jewish people in 1947, as did, you know, the American government, the British government, and so on. And this is an old theory. It's a theory that says that the world is best governed. And this is a theory we used to call nationalism. The world is best governed when different nations are free to have independence by which they can pursue their own religious traditions, their own national and legal traditions, each one of them being a kind of an experiment in what it means to be human. This is a kind of freedom, of a vision of a world of free nations in which you don't have some kind of central power in Brussels or at the United Nations or someplace, which dictates to all the nations of the world a law that makes them uniform.
And it comes down in the end to sovereignty, doesn't it? That those experiments require having sovereign nation status and all of the rights that flow from it. And you know, I wanted just to pivot, if I could, in our remaining time with you, Yoram, to talk about threats to that Jewish state, notably from the Palestinians over the years. We've been witnessing in recent days, as you're well aware, some tectonic shifts, I think it's fair to say, on the part of U.S. government policy. I had a chance to speak yesterday with David Goldman, Asia Times, about this, and we discussed it in the several things that President Trump has done recently, including moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Israel's capital of Jerusalem. And the thing that was so impressive to me was, as we were talking, that it sounded an awful lot like what our mutual friend Daniel Pipes has described as kind of an Israel victory strategy at last, to have a recognition that Israel actually defeated the Palestinians and other Arabs and has created conditions under which it really can quite rightly set the terms for the kind of relationship that it will have with the Palestinians going forward, rather than everything having to be subject to negotiations with incredibly intransigent, indeed jihadist, enemies of Israel. What are your thoughts on that as it relates to this issue of Israel's sovereign and national aspirations and requirements?
The idea that Israel alone among the nations of the earth should be denied the right to determine its own capital, to determine that Jerusalem is the capital of the state of Israel. It's one of these ugly diplomatic fictions which Western diplomats have participated in, but were originally generated by all sorts of nastier powers which wanted to harm the West. And one of the things that's admirable about the Trump administration is its impatience with ugly fictions. When, you know, everybody's pretending that Jerusalem isn't Israel's capital, it definitely says a great deal about President Trump and his team that they're willing and able to say, look, this just isn't true. It's just it's false. Israel's capital is Jerusalem, and I think we'll see more of that going forward. That the Trump administration appears to be willing to recognize reality, even when that reality is unpleasant and sometimes foreign relations that's the case, is that you have to be willing to say the truth.
Yeah. And more to the point, it does seem to me, and we're just hard out of time here, Yoram, so we're going to have to return to this hopefully very soon, but it does seem to me that it's not just necessary to have your policies rooted in reality, but you must disabuse people that your willingness to suspend reality isn't simply an inducement to them to continue, at best, intransigence, and at worst, a sort of jihadist conflict with the nation of Israel. We appreciate tremendously what you do to articulate the case for Israel, Yoram, including in your new book, The Virtue of Nationalism. I'm very keen to sit down with you and go through that in some detail, and appreciate your time today and the work you're doing at the Herzl Institute. Let's reconvene soon. Next up, we will talk with Dan Gray about developments on Capitol Hill with respect to our military and the prospects for Afghanistan and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
It's a great pleasure to say we are joined by Dr. Daniel Gray. He is, by my lights, one of the smartest guys in certainly Washington and arguably the country when it comes to matters involving our national security. Dan is these days a vice president of the Lexington Institute, a nonprofit policy research organization based here in the Washington, D.C. area. He has, however, served in government as well, including as the director of the Office of Strategic Competitiveness in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, I believe in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. He has been associated with a number of other think tanks around town over the years. He has consulted for the Departments of State, Defense, and Energy. He has taught at Johns Hopkins University, my alma mater. He is an extraordinary resource, and it is always a privilege to have him with us. Dan Gray, thank you so much for taking a few minutes.
Always my pleasure.
Well, Dan, I want to talk about a number of different things in your beat. The interesting development, if not unprecedented, certainly I can't remember the last time it happened, that the Defense Appropriations Bill seems to have been completed on time by the United States Congress. How important is that? And do you find what they've done, to the extent it's clear, to be consistent with the needs at the moment?
Well, it certainly is a big change. It's been over a decade since this was last accomplished. And getting a budget on time not only is important for national defense, but it's really important for the taxpayer, because if you go with continuing resolution, it ends up costing money. You can't start new programs. So this is fiscally sound as well as prudent for national defense. And there's money in it for a lot of good things, more F-35 Joint Strike Fighters, increased production of modernized tanks and armored vehicles, which are going to go to Europe, additional production of missile defense capabilities, and they're funding the nuclear modernization for our triad.
All incalculably important, and particularly those last two items, Dan. And I did want to ask you about a couple things in connection therewith. I participated in a briefing on Capitol Hill last week, which there was considerable emphasis made by senior Defense Department officials, both on the policy side and on the acquisition side, about the imperative of upgrading our missile defense capabilities in light of threats that are now present or coming online in Russia and China. And one of the things that was striking there, which I have the feeling is operating as well in getting this defense appropriations bill done, is a seeming consensus, at least for the moment, that has emerged on the need for even space-based missile defenses on both sides of the aisle. And Mike Griffin, the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, quipped in the course of the briefing that he thought one of the reasons, at least, why that was so is, as he put it, quote, the threat has voted, unquote. And I just wonder, first of all, your thoughts on the threat, and secondly, on the fact of this seeming emerging more bipartisan sense of urgency in addressing such threats?
Well, those who in Congress who have heard the various threat briefings out of the Department of Defense and the intelligence community have basically had their hair set on fire. Our competitors and adversaries have been investing very heavily, not only in traditional nuclear and long-range strike capabilities, but in the advanced capabilities, hypersonics. And the problem with that is you may not see it, you will certainly won't hear it until it lands, and there isn't a conventional defense, the kind of missile defense we've been deploying for the last 20 or so years, that can touch it. The only way you're going to be able to get at these hypersonic weapons to essentially deter the threat to the United States is from space. One other thing. We know that the Russians and Chinese are working very hard on systems to essentially take out our satellites, to blind us even before these strikes. And having our own capabilities, weapons in space for defensive purposes, is now equally important if we are going to be safe.
Amen to that. It remains to be seen, of course, how enduring this seeming consensus will be, especially if the Congress changes hands in the fall. But it's promising and I think certainly warranted. Dan, let me talk about a couple of things that you've been focusing on as well. And again, our guest is Dr. Daniel Goray of the Lexington Institute. You can follow his work at lexingtoninstitute.org. You've written a warning, basically, I think it's fair to say, about pulling the plug, as you put it, on Afghanistan. Is that in the offing, as you see it, these talks with the Taliban and the sort of thoughts being given again to reposturing there? And just walk us through, Dan, if you would, what you think the implications would be of, cutting and running, as it were.
Yeah, well, we've managed to, at great cost, including lives of our soldiers and Marines, to essentially stabilize the situation. But we found no way of really winning this war. It is essentially a stalemate, and it's likely to be that way in perpetuity. And therefore, the concern of the administration is, how do we bring this to some kind of resolution? And that, in the end, requires continual and even heavier support for the Afghan government and its military forces, in particular providing them with the logistics and maintenance and training, aircraft, for example, light attack aircraft, so that they can continue to essentially fight if necessary or come to some terms with the Taliban, with elements of the Taliban, if you like. So there really isn't a solution. We're either going to be there forever or we're going to have to push this to some kind of negotiation, but based on equals.
I wonder if you've given some thought, as I suspect you have, to a measure that has been proposed most prominently by Eric Prince to essentially change the character of our involvement in Afghanistan, to remain present, to continue to fight the Taliban through primarily contractor personnel, lightening the footprint of the U.S. military and conceivably, considerably enhancing the wherewithal of our so-called Afghan allies.
You know, the real problem with trying to privatize this effort is that no private security capability is going to equal what we can do with the U.S. military. And I'm not talking about combat or counterterrorism or even counter-narcotics. It's the logistics. It's the sustainment. It's the intelligence. It's all those things that we excel at, the U.S. military excels at, and that you don't get from a private security. It's not hiring former Green Berets and special forces. It's training. It's all those things that will keep the Afghan forces in the field. And that's the key to being able to bring this to a conclusion. Mm.
An interesting point, and one I look forward to running by Eric Prince at some point soon and getting his thoughts on it too. Because I think he believes that there's more inherent capability in some of these contractors than it might sound. Let me turn to another topic. Dan, you and I have talked about this over the years, and I really commend the work that you do on it at Lexington, and that is the defense industrial base and the need for that as part of an overall, I think of it as peace through strength posture. A kind of variation on that theme or manifestation of it in a way is our shipbuilding capability. And specifically, you've recently written about the imperative of having a viable U.S. commercial fleet. I note that as you've written this, somebody pointed out to me that China has been recently dubbed the number one maritime power in the world. Talk about the implications of that and what that says to you about our commercial fleet requirements.
The important thing for the United States is to have the capacity to project and power and then sustain it. That requires moving supplies, troops, ammunition halfway around the world. That's done by essentially the U.S. flagged commercial fleet. And that fleet is down to essentially a handful of vessels. It's supported by the Maritime Administration special programs, including, for example, the Jones Act, which keeps U.S. flagged ships in the trade in U.S. waters. If you don't have that, you're dependent upon foreign flag carriers, including now the Chinese as the great maritime power. And are they going to be willing to support the U.S. military in all events?
Would we trust them to do so is another question, isn't it? Even if they were willing.
Absolutely. So the question is, if they're willing, and we've had cases, certainly in the first Gulf War, where foreign flag vessels refused to go into the combat zone, if you will, with critical supplies for the U.S. military. So if you don't have a U.S. flag fleet, we are no longer a global power.
And Dan, a related point, which you helpfully called to my attention, among others, is that we're beginning to see the fruits relatively rapidly, fortunately, of improvements in our air mobility. When you talk about projecting power, of course, that's been a key component of it. Discuss, if you would, quickly the entrance of the KC-46 tanker.
Well, the KC-46 has had some teething problems. It has overcome virtually all of them. It now has its FAA certification. We'll have its military certification, which means the first one will be entering the force this year, and the production is now up to more than 50 units. We're going to buy at least 180 or so, probably twice that number of this aircraft to replace our older tankers. And with these, we can now send aircraft overseas for humanitarian missions or military conflict missions faster, more reliably, and projecting power that way is a real example of peace through strength.
It is indeed. Well, we would appreciate, as always, your continuing admonitions about what we need to make that not just a rhetorical policy, but a practical one through congressional action as well as the leadership of the executive branch, military and civilian. Dan Garay, again, I thank you for your service in the Pentagon, as well as that you continue to render splendidly at the Lexington Institute. And I wanted to commend especially to our listeners a new strategy that Dan Garay has authored about competing with the Russians in Europe. And that has become a more urgent task at the moment, especially as we're watching play out the kinds of war games that the Russians are engaged in. We'll talk more about that with Bill Gertz in just a moment. But Dan, thank you so much for joining us. Come back to us again soon. Bill Gertz takes us inside the ring right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit inside the ring. That is, of course, the prize-winning column's title at the Washington Times by its author, Bill Gertz, who we are always pleased to have with us. Bill is also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, an incredibly valuable resource for monitoring what is going on here in the Washington area and beyond. And I had the privilege of having Bill Gertz with us, as we did indeed Dan Garay, our previous guest, at our annual Keeper of the Flame dinner last night, honoring the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes. And Bill, thank you so much for being part of that celebration of some wonderful patriots, including Devin Nunes.
Yeah, hi, Frank. Good to be on the program. 30th anniversary banquet. I've been to many, many Keeper of the Flame dinners going back decades. I can remember some of the great awardees that were there. It's truly a monumental event for Washington, and definitely a leading something that I always look forward to every year.
Well, it's a privilege to have you with us year after year. One of the things that Chairman Nunes made a point of saying in his remarks, Bill, was that China is the real enemy. And this is really a surprise if you've watched the work he's done with his committee trying to explore both the military buildup and the economic warfare that the Chinese have engaged in. But you've recently written up, in addition to sort of those broad topics, specifically about some testimony of an Assistant Secretary of Defense by the name of Randall Shriver. And I wanted to draw you out on what he's been saying about something called predatory economics, which I found a fascinating way of capturing a big part of the problem at the moment.
Yeah, I did an interview with the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Affairs, Security Affairs, Randy Shriver, who is really good on the issue of China, has been studying the issue, has worked at both the Pentagon and State Department in previous administrations. And he was kind enough to grant me an interview where he talked about how the Chinese military is intimately involved with this major Chinese infrastructure development program around the world called the Belt and Road Initiative. And he revealed that as part of the latest Pentagon report to Congress on the Chinese military, that this is going to be part of the military's use of foreign bases and foreign access agreements to be able to project power. So this is really, he kind of exposed the Chinese strategy of expanding their power now that China has kind of consolidated its grip on the country in through the Communist Party there. And now they're expanding globally to try to use predatory economics. And they do that by lending. They make these massive billion-dollar loans with strings attached. And the strings include no criticism of China. And in many cases, they have to adopt the Chinese style of dictatorship, this collective dictatorship that is running the Chinese system now in Beijing.
Yeah. Bill, again, this was a point that Devin Nunes spoke about, this infrastructure as a vehicle for essentially accomplishing sort of kind of through payday loans is the way I think of it. Access and assets from which to project power, as you and Secretary Shriver are saying. Bill, one of the things that you pointed out is that there is a national defense strategy that's been recently promulgated that is designed to try to address some of these developments. Talk us through that.
Yeah, this is a very, very significant development in the sense that for the first time in decades, the Trump administration, first through the national security strategy at the White House and now earlier this year at the Pentagon through the national defense strategy, they've shifted the focus from Islamic terrorism to big power competition. And they kind of lump Russia and China together. But as you mentioned, Nunes pointed out that the real threat is from China. It's not from Russia. I mean, Russia does pose a threat because of its nuclear buildup and its aggression. But the Chinese are really the big threat, and they're moving around the world. And it's important that the United States counter that threat, and they're beginning to do that. Now, the government is still on autopilot on the China is not a threat kind of policies, but that is changing. It's like kind of like a super tanker. It takes a lot of effort and to change the policy, but hopefully they'll maintain the course and we will see significant changes in policies towards China, which will be able to mitigate this growing threat, which again is not just from the military. It's economic, it's political, it's intelligence, it's diplomatic. It's a broad array of threats coming from China, and we're just in the early stages of recognizing that threat, but it's a positive development.
Yeah. You know, I was talking in the previous segment with Dan Garay about what seems to be an emerging bipartisan consensus on some things, and it would seem that China is now one of them as well. And Bill, you have written about the importance in this national security or national defense strategy that Taiwan is now taking on, and efforts that are being made to enhance the air and missile defense capabilities of a nation that is, well, not regarded as a nation at all by the Chinese, of course, and that they've made no secret they intend to take back one way or the other. But to protect and help the Taiwanese, particularly protecting themselves.
Yeah, they're moving against Taiwan in through the diplomatic arena. They've managed to convince three of the nations, most of them in South America and Central America, that had diplomatic relations with Taiwan. They've convinced them to switch, obviously through massive funding, basically bribing those countries. And so the U.S. has taken action recently by recalling its ambassadors from El Salvador and two other states to basically protest this Chinese diplomatic aggression against Taiwan. So that's also a good point. I know Randy Shriver, he worked for the Project 2049 Institute, which was very focused on trying to help Taiwan bolster its defenses. And in his interview with me, he said that they're going to regularize the foreign military sales. We used to do these in large packages that would be held up by pro-China officials in government to avoid offending Beijing. And now they're going to do it on the same basis that we sell weapons to other states, whether it's in Europe or South America or other places like that. So that's another good sign that the policy is shifting.
Yeah, very, very definitely. Hey, Bill, in just in the last minute or two we've got, quickly, you mentioned in one of your recent pieces that China is estimated to have 260 warheads. And you go on to observe that they may have considerably more than that. I had an interesting conversation with Dan Gallington about this yesterday, and he was taking exception to the ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee, Representative Adam Smith of Washington, who claimed that they had 500. Dan said, we don't have a clue what they've got. It could be 10 times that number. Just very quickly, Bill, what is your sense of the thinking of the Pentagon on the magnitude of this Chinese nuclear buildup, as well as the lengths that China is going to conceal it from us?
I raised this question in my interview with Assistant Secretary of Defense Shriver, and he basically said that the big problem is, as you said, we don't know. It's a transparency issue. Unlike the Cold War and the Soviet Union and later Russia, Moscow was often very eager to engage in arms control agreements, often which limited us and they cheated on them. But the process was revealing in the sense that they would give up numbers and systems and launchers and things like that, as you well know. That's not the case with the Chinese. They believe in utmost secrecy regarding their nuclear forces, and they have a 3,000-mile underground nuclear complex, which was revealed about 5 years ago in public. And so the numbers are not really known, and it's clearly a major threat that they're building up their nuclear forces with missiles and new nuclear weapons.
Yeah. And Bill, we're out of time, but I know you've been covering closely, and when we get you back next week, I hope we'll have a chance to talk in more detail about Vostok 18, in which the Chinese and Russians have been collaborating in what sure looks a lot like, well, a prescription for World War III, including nuclear strikes against the United States homeland. But that's for another day. Bill, thank you for your time today, as well as for the incredibly important work you do, reporting on all of these issues at the Washington Free Beacon and the Washington Times. Bill, we'll talk with you next week. We'll talk with the rest of you, I hope, as well next week. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.